it's an emergent area of interest for a lot of people, and I think it's so ingrained in our daily life.
One way you can do that with polytrained athletes is take them to
those tiny babies.
And I guess for every day when I'm working
with patients, we expect a baby to look
like. It is a topic which is often highly emotive.
Think.
This is Think Help on 2SER 107.3.
Hello and welcome to Think Health, where we cultivate and articulate the best in health research. I'm Ellen Liebeder and you're tuned in to 2SER 107.3. On the show today, we examine whether Dr. Google is giving you the right information on infant feeding and how nurses perceive parents of extremely premature babies that hope for a miracle.
For the nurses, they kind of walk a tightrope in as much that encouraging hope and not taking hope away.
But first on the show today, chronic pain. If you've ever had a sore back or headache, you will be aware of what it's like to be in pain. You can't sleep, you can't work, exercise is definitely out of the question, and this can also have an effect on your social relationships. But for most of us, this pain passes and we can get on with our day-to-day lives. But for sufferers of chronic pain, the pain never goes away, which means sufferers are often left without a proper diagnosis or treatment. Over 2 million people in Australia suffer from chronic pain, and it's recognised as one of the fastest growing medical conditions in Australia. In just under a month's time, Chronic Pain Australia will be raising awareness of chronic pain for National Pain Week. Devon Silver explains what chronic pain is and why we need to reduce the stigma attached to the condition.
Chronic pain is referred to as the invisible burden. Unseen from the surface, and sufferers often internalise their experience due to the negative stigma which surrounds pain. Laura Winkler is a 27-year-old government lawyer and has been suffering with chronic pain in both her arms and across her chest for 3.5 years. She spoke about how she struggles with this stigma.
People think of chronic pain and they think of elderly people and they think of people who have some kind of obvious physical illness, whereas you look at me and I look perfectly healthy. There's nothing to indicate that I'd be struggling with pain like this. And I think that's probably the hardest thing to describe to people, what you're experiencing, without sounding like you're complaining or anything like that, but really wanting people to understand exactly what you're going through. Pain is something that can happen to anyone, and just because people look okay doesn't mean that they feel it.
To help raise awareness of chronic pain in our society, Chronic Pain Australia is running National Pain Week from the 20th to the 26th of July. President of Chronic Pain Australia, Coralie Wales, says it aims to reduce the stigma and isolation which comes with chronic pain.
Chronic Pain Australia is an organisation that, through its National Pain Week intervention and other activities during the year, we try to change the culture around people in pain from one where people are isolated and where the community doesn't really understand why somebody would be in long-term pain, to one where the community does understand how chronic pain works. And in doing all of that, we aim to reduce the isolation and the suffering that comes with chronic pain. There's a lot of mythology about, well, you know, if you've got long-term pain, you might have a low pain threshold. A lot of people think that. And so, you know, the reality for a lot of people is that this pain doesn't go away. And so even family members and close friends can say, well, what's wrong with you? Mm. You know, I've had pain, I've had a sore back, but it goes away, or I deal with it. So why can't you? And there's that kind of suggestion that it might be about weakness. That's not the case at all. But that experience of the people around you or just the general community can lead to, if you are experiencing chronic pain, it can lead to not wanting to talk about it, wanting to keep it to yourself. And so if you can't go down to the local restaurant on a Friday night because you can't sit that long, or if you can't go to your club or wherever you recreate, wherever you relax, If you can't go because you can't sit for that long, or your pain is so overwhelming that you can't concentrate on what people are saying, then you start staying at home. You know, the experience does lead to isolation.
Miss Wales also explains why people do not understand chronic pain.
Well, we all grow up with pain. You know, we all know what it is to graze your knee or to fall out of a, you know, fall down steps. You hurt yourself, the pain, it hurts. You go to the doctor perhaps, and then it gets better and the pain goes away. We get that. That's what we understand because, you know, that's human. Sometimes the pain doesn't go away. And when it doesn't go away, when it becomes long-term, that's called chronic pain. And once it does become chronic, it's less about the place where you've hurt yourself and more about multiple body systems like the immune system, the nervous system, the endocrine system or the hormone system, and even the gut. And that involvement can lead to really complex experience of pain where it's not about a short-term acute pain. It's now about multiple body systems, and often it's about a traumatic onset. Now, so chronic pain is really much more complex than short-term or acute pain.
Dr. Samantha Robotham, Research Assistant at the UTS Faculty of Health's Centre for Health Service Management, explained that the lack of understanding is a result from there being no shared reference.
It's difficult to put pain into words. So when we're trying to talk about pain, we have take what's essentially an internal private sensation, and then we have to try and find the words to describe that pain in a way that others will understand it, and then they need to take that message and interpret it in the way that we intended them to interpret it. So we're taking this kind of private experience and trying to get it out there in words. And that's difficult because when we're trying to find the words that we're using for pain, we've only got a limited number of words to choose from anyway. And there's so many different types of pain, and these words might be used to describe different kinds of pains in different kinds of ways. And the problem here is that we don't have a shared reference to apply these words to. So, for example, if you're trying to teach your child what the colour red is, you're trying to teach them what the word red means, you can point to something that's red and say, "This is red." With pain, you can't do that. So if I say, "This is a stinging pain," there's only me that knows what that stinging pain means. I can't say to someone else, "This is what stinging is." So there's no shared reference to be able to establish a meaning for these words. So we're relying on an assumption that other people know what we mean when we use these pain words.
Chronic pain is hard to diagnose and treat, as it occurs from multiple medical issues, and where you feel the pain is usually not the source of the pain. Thus, National Pain Week also aims to help sufferers and their medical professionals find effective treatment regimes. Vali Grego is a 52-year-old teacher who suffered with chronic pain for 20 years. She explained her difficult experience getting a diagnosis and finding a treatment.
A good 20 years ago, I had an accident and I damaged my rotator cuff and I had to have surgery. And after the surgery, obviously I had a great deal of intensive treatment. But along with that, I had a great deal of neck pain and back pain, so not just shoulder pain. And I lost count how many therapists I went to, how many specialists I went to, and I was even diagnosed as having arthritis in my neck. Okay, it was all, but nobody related it back to the injury, and it just kept getting worse and worse. I was getting chronic headaches, so I was taking copious amounts of Nurofen and Panadol throughout the day just to see me through the day, basically. And it really didn't matter what I did. I mean, we're talking about acupuncture, we're talking about physio, we're talking about remedial massage, we're talking about anything that you could actually think of. After a while, I just stopped going because it just appeared to be a complete and utter waste of money. And you just ended up living with the pain miserably, but you did, and you did what you had to do.
There has been extensive research into pain and the differing ways of communicating and treating pain. Ms. Grego's life has been completely changed by photobiomodulation, a low-level laser therapy which is a non-surgical and drug-free treatment for chronic pain, and is already recognised in many countries as a genuine alternative to drugs and surgery.
First, I've got to tell you, I was extremely sceptical, and the reason I was extremely sceptical was because, you know, I wasn't actually experiencing any pain. during the treatments, sort of thinking, well, this is just a load of hogwash, really. And I thought, no, well, I'll try, because at the end of the treatment, I could actually turn my head without experiencing some pain.
Vali has undergone the treatments for 1 year, and the results have changed her life.
I hadn't been back for 2 months now, and I'm telling you that you can touch my neck now, and I feel absolutely no pain. If you had told me that I would be like this at the end of last year, if you've had any form of chronic pain, you've got to give this a go. If you haven't tried this, then you haven't tried everything.
Dr. Robotham told me how research into the communication of pain may reduce isolation and improve treatment.
What we've got to think about is how can we make it easier to get those internal sensations out there and understood by others? How do we improve the language that we have to talk about pain? How do we make it less likely that people will misinterpret the words that we use?
Ms. Wales says National Pain Week is concentrating on the importance of the communication of pain in finding ways to improve the quality of life for people suffering with chronic pain.
This year, we're calling it pain. Let's talk about it. Given that people don't want to talk about it, given that there are things that people don't talk about in relation to pain, we thought we might just make that our theme. We hire the big red double-decker London bus throughout the week, and we call out to the community and say, would you like to come and have a ride with us? Where would you like to go? Let's go and have a picnic. Let's go and pick up some kids from the kids' hospital that are in the pain clinic there. Let's just get involved and get active and have a few laughs and help people get out and about during National Pain Week. So this year, coming up, we'll be spending 2 days on the Big Red Bus in Brisbane and 3 days on the Big Red Bus in Sydney, culminating in a one-day conference at the State Libraries, where we have speakers talking about really interesting things, talking about the stuff that's hard to talk about, professors of pain medicine, people that live with pain, experts in different types of pain, and, you know, just trying to really get a bit of attention to the fact that people do live with chronic pain, but that it's not hopeless, that there are things that people can do, and I guess that's the other side of the coin.
That was President of Chronic Pain Australia, Coralie Wales, finishing up that report from Devon Silver. You're listening to Think Health on 2SER. Up next, we chat about information overload for parents looking to Dr. Google and mobile apps for answers on infant feeding.
UTS has invested in improving our students' learning environment through amazing new facilities, courses, and ways of teaching. Our students have noticed the difference.
The students, the staff members, everybody's so helpful, everybody's so relaxed and is willing to take the time out of the day to help you. It's such a great vibe here at UTS, and I wouldn't see myself studying anywhere else.
UTS is Australia's most innovative campus designed for you to live, learn and enjoy your journey. UTS sponsors 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Think Health on 2SER 107.3.
Welcome back to Think Health on 2SER. Now, if you Google infant feeding, you get over 65 million results. Some results are obviously more helpful and reliable. For example, the National Health and Medical Research Council's infant feeding guidelines. But others often give misleading or just plain wrong information on how to feed your newborn. This incorrect information can cause problems down the track as children develop unhealthy eating habits. Sarah Tarkey is a PhD student in the Faculty of Health at the University of Technology, Sydney. She has been looking at the range of websites and apps available to parents about infant feeding with some interesting results.
Well, we know that the internet is definitely becoming a popular source to seek health-related information. There's been a study, the Google Consumer Survey, and they found that expecting parents conduct internet searches twice as frequently as non-parents. And I guess this is a concern because there are so many websites and apps available about infant feeding. There is also a concern in regards to the quality of these websites and apps.
So let's talk a bit about the study that you've just done. You've looked at websites and apps in regards to infant feeding. Why that particular area?
I guess it is important that parents have access to reliable sources about infant feeding, which and these infant feeding practices might include breastfeeding, formula feeding, the timing of solid introduction, healthy first foods, as well as feeding to the baby's appetite. So feeding behaviours in the first year of life, they play a major role on both short-term and long-term health. For example, the behaviours that are practiced on the infant at that age tends to track from early childhood into adulthood. So it's really important that the parent is practicing healthy infant feeding behaviours to influence the future behaviours in a positive manner.
And how many of these apps and websites did you analyse?
We overall screened a number of websites and apps, and then we analysed 44 websites and 46 apps using tools that have already been developed to measure the quality of these health websites and apps.
And how did you assess the quality?
There are particular tools that have already been developed to measure health-based websites. And so there were two particular tools that we had used. And the features to measure the quality that determined whether it was good or poor quality included evaluating the information on the websites and apps. And this was actually done by comparing the information that's available on there with the Australian Infant Feeding Guidelines. So to see whether the information is accurate and reliable. Other features that are included in this quality tool is the credibility of the developer, so identifying who developed these websites and apps and whether they are of professional background or whether they're just a layperson. Currency is also another feature which is also measured in this quality tool. And I guess it's important that the website or the app has been updated according to the current or the latest Australian Infant Feeding Guideline.
Out of these 40-odd websites and apps that you looked at, what percentage of them were considered good quality apps?
There were literally around 2 to 5 apps that were considered to be good quality. And they provided information about who developed the app. They provided accurate information. And also the look and feel of the app was also appealing. So they had appropriate colours. You were able to zoom into the writing if you needed to see it a bit more clearer. The pictures that they used were also suitable to the app as well.
Some of these apps that were considered poor quality were actually commercial websites and apps that were developed by commercial entities. What role do they play in all this?
I guess because commercial apps tend to have a sense of familiarity to parents, and parents may feel a bit of may feel that these commercial apps are quite trustworthy because they are aware of the commercial product, so they may tend to use it.
One example was one of the chain supermarkets in Australia did have an app, so I guess there would be a bit of a brand association there if you visit that supermarket.
Yeah, exactly right, exactly. And because of that, they may tend to actually use that website or that app developed by that particular company. But because commercial apps are particularly targeting a specific product, they may not represent the existing evidence base. So it could be quite concerning and misleading if parents tend to use these information, as there may be misleading information and causing them to practice unhealthy infant feeding behaviours.
Now, websites and apps change constantly. What skills can parents use to assess the quality of what's out there?
I guess it's a bit of a tricky one, especially because parents, particularly with infants, have a lack of time to sit there and search for features that they know they need to check whether the app is of good quality or poor quality, and so that it's trustworthy. So it's important that parents know where the information is from and who the information is actually coming from as well. And so I guess the go-to source I would recommend is government sources. For example, the Australian Infant Feeding Guidelines. We know that it's evidence-based. From this study, we have actually developed our own infant app called Growing Healthy. And the app particularly targets infants that are from 0 to 9 months of age, targeting different feeding behaviours or practices, such as breastfeeding, information about formula feeding practices, information about when to introduce solids and also how. although we're trialing that out now, we're hoping that we will eventually be able to have it accessible to the public so they would be able to have a source that they can use and trust.
As a researcher, do you think it would be beneficial to also have, say, a body that's can ascertain what apps and websites are useful and have, say, a logo to say, yes, this is good to use? Would that make it quicker and easier for parents?
Most definitely. I think it's definitely something that I would recommend and that I've actually recommended after completing this study, because it would allow parents to see that logo and like you said, they would then know it's immediately a trusted source that they can just use. And I'm hoping that in the future there would be, whether it is a government body which have developed this logo to certify websites, health websites and apps. And it is definitely out there already for websites, but not necessarily apps yet.
Sarah Tarkey from the University of Technology Sydney there. And if you would like to find out more about the app Sarah has been developing along with her team, head to our website at 2ser.com/thinkhealth. Here on 2SER, you're listening to Think Health. I'm Ellen Leibeder. Stay tuned, because up next, we juggle the perceptions of miracles for extremely premature babies.
Are you wondering where your career could go next? UTS Postgraduate Info Sessions will give you the knowledge to decide which postgraduate program is in your future. Postgraduate Info Sessions are at UTS Broadway, where you can learn everything you need to know from UTS academics before enrolling for courses starting in July. Visit the UTS website and click on Postgraduate for the dates, times, and registration details. UTS. Own the knowledge. Own your future. UTS sponsors 2SER 107.3.
Would you like to buy 2SER a decent pair of headphones? Well, you can by making a $53.64 tax-deductible donation. Your donation doesn't have to be $53.64. It can be whatever you can afford. Just go to 2ser.com and click on the Support 2SER button. Then click on the green once-off tax-deductible donation button, fill in your details and click Confirm. Your receipt will be emailed to you straight away. Make your tax-deductible donation to 2SER today.
You're listening to Think Health on 2SER 107.3.
Welcome back to Think Health. For parents with strong religious beliefs, hoping for a miracle for a sick child is common. However, for extremely premature babies, defined as age 24 weeks gestation or less, hoping for a miracle can be a delicate balancing act. A new study has looked at how nurses perceive parents who believe in divine intervention. The study found that while parents didn't want to lose hope their baby would survive, hoping for divine intervention can also needlessly prolong the inevitable. PhD student and registered nurse Janet Green from the Faculty of Health at the University of Technology Sydney explains.
This particular study is only about babies of 24 weeks gestation and less, okay? So it can't be applied to any other gestation. But it was when they had to care for parents and the baby whose religious beliefs were such that they believed in a miracle. And they were hoping for divine intervention. And for the nurses, they had seen this many times, and they were sad that the nurses stated, all of them stated, that they'd not seen a miracle. And they were very sad and disappointed for the parents when a miracle wasn't forthcoming. So it was really about, but they also recognised that, you know, people, the religious beliefs that people base their very lives upon, can be very confronting for the family, and to lose hope, you know, if they lose hope, they lose everything. So it's really about, for the nurses, they kind of walk a tightrope in as much that encouraging hope and not taking hope away. But for the nurses, there came a time when they've waited and no miracle has happened. But some of the quotes were things like, another set of disappointed parents, for example, who had hoped for a miracle. So, yeah, it's a very difficult situation for the family and also for the nurses.
And you also used the case study of baby K. Can you tell us a bit about this?
Baby K, I did my bioethics master's dissertation on Baby K, and Baby K was an anencephalic. An anencephalic is a baby who is born without a brain. And so if you think about the human brain, or very simplistically, the thinking parts at the top in the cortex and the automatic stuff like breathing and our cranial nerves is in the brainstem. So an anencephalic baby is a baby that is born without a cortex. So it may have a beating heart, it may breathe, it may suck on a feed, but there is no cortex there. So there's no meaningful human interaction, or the way I would define meaningful human interaction. So most of them are stillborn, but the occasional baby will survive. So in America, Baby Kay was born, and her mother was very religious, and her mother had asked the neonatologist to, so that she could say goodbye to her baby, to intubate the baby and ventilate the baby. Problem with the American law at the time was once that happened, they couldn't withdraw treatment, and she refused. Baby Kay was kept alive for 2.5 years on life support. The case even went to court because even though treatment was considered futile, inasmuch that although they could ventilate her lungs, she was never going to grow a brain. The Baby K case is still held up in neonatal circles as the case that everybody needs to be concerned about. But she existed, however you want to define it, for 2.5 years. And so this was Baby K's mother was hoping for a miracle, and obviously a miracle didn't come.
That withdrawal of treatment is quite an interesting issue. In Australia, are we allowed to withdraw treatments?
The law is such that there is nothing in law that says you have to burden anyone with treatment. However, it needs to be obvious that that the person is not going to survive or is not going to survive with an acceptable outcome. Withdrawal of life support is never, ever taken lightly. There are discussions with families, there is diagnostics, and it really needs to be proven what the outcome or no outcome is likely to be. It's a very difficult time for families because to have... This basically is withdrawal of life support really means that there is no more hope. But it is done, from what I have seen, with much compassion. In a neonatal perspective, we create memories for the parents, so footprints, handprints, locks of hair if they want, lots of photos. It's incredibly important, particularly so for a newborn. This family may not actually have any memories, whereas an older child or an adult, everybody's got lots of memories. So one of the roles of the nurses is to help create memories for that family. And it's done with incredible compassion and sensitivity.
One of the things that really stood out for me in this paper was that parents who were continuously hoping for a miracle and the baby died while on life support, but they didn't get the opportunity to hold their baby because mm-hmm. they were hoping for a miracle until the end.
The incredibly sad situations have occurred. That is true. Normally, what would happen is that the parents would hold the baby. I mean, the parents are all part of this. We encourage that they be there because you only get one chance at this. And there's lots of parents who've regretted not being there. And I'm not sure if there are any parents who've regretted being there. So it's if they can manage it with the support of family, friends and the nursing staff to be there. But to be able to, certain families don't want to go down that track and the baby dies on life support. And it's incredibly sad for the nurses because babies should be dying in somebody's arms who loves them.
Janet Green, a PhD student from the University of Technology, Sydney, ending that report. If you would like to hear that story again or listen to any of our past programs, head to our website at 2ser.com/thinkhealth. This show is produced with the support of the University of Technology, Sydney, Faculty of Health.
Please remember that you should not consider the contents of this show medical advice, and you should consult your physician if you have any concerns. I'm Ellen Liebeder. This has been Think Health. Thanks for your company.